in 2015 or 16 or so, it's hard to say for sure now, I had decided that I was going to learn enough acoustic guitar to be able to sing a few songs, and found a place that had an open mic in Ben Wheeler, Texas, basically between Tyler and Canton. We'd been there a few times for the open mics. There was this dude there that was an incredible guitar player, but he was also incredibly kind to the people coming in there to play, regardless of their level. He would, most of the time, often sit in and play with them. That was a big help to me, and that's where I met Craig Wallace, and he was obviously extremely gifted as a musician. He's a great person as well, and was, like I said, just let me kind of do my thing and play along with me, and I would try to tell them the song or what key it was in. He said, it don't matter, just start playing. Then he would fill in as he saw fit for that particular night. It was a good time. Had I stuck with the guitar, I would be much better off today. The only reason I really picked up the guitar in the first place was to be able to maybe sing a few more places, and that's still what I really like to do. But when I see people like Craig play the guitar, it makes me pick up mine pull it off the wall and try to learn a few basic things, because I always feel better after having heard some music. I didn't get a chance in the episode to give his website where you can find his music. He's got a new CD out called Water Bears No Scars, and you can get that and listen to a lot of Craig's music and read a little bit about his story at craigwallacemusic.com. That's CraigWallace music.com. I hope you enjoy this episode. Definitely check out Craig Wallace, and if you're ever in Ben Wheeler, Texas, sometimes maybe you'll get to hear him play.
You ever heard of George Lynch?
No, I don't think so.
From Dokken?
I've heard of Dokken. Is that, they were,
yeah,
kind of 80s?
Dokken or whatever their name was. George was a guitar player for them, and apparently in California, he was number two under Eddie Van Halen.
Okay.
And I met him. I was there to help him out, do some stuff, pick out a vintage amp. And I've never seen a man more swamped the whole time that he's doing. You know, he's there. And I'm like, who is it? It's sort of like they're going, you know, they're going, the Hager brothers are there.
Oh,
you know?
Yeah.
It's like,
just people,
big
coming
deal.
Up to, yeah.
You know, big deal. When I dialed in an amp for George Lynch, I've seen whole groups at the Saturday Night Jam when George is there. And you see all these guys watching everybody playing and looking with earnest. But I see guys that are looking like, that's all shit. You're all playing shit. Let George play. You know, and then George plays and they just light up like a Christmas tree. And mm-hmm. they're just in nirvana.
Yeah.
Because they love his playing. I dialed in his plexi. And he called me up one day and said, hey, well, I played the guitar show with him one time, and because he needed me. He called me up and goes, yeah, man, I just heard it from Eddie Van Halen's tech that this Marshall is better than Eddie's Marshall. And I go, well, great, George, could you do me a favor? And he goes, yeah. And I said, keep it to yourself. Don't tell anybody. I'm not doing that anymore. So 6 months later, I get a phone call. Got to A, and they said, is Craig Wallace there? And I go, this is Craig Wallace. Are you the same Craig Wallace that dialed in George Lynch's Plexi 67? I go, yep, I am. He goes, look, I have a 67 Plexi, and I want to send it to you, and I want you to go through it and set it like you did for George, so it'll sound like George Lynch. I said, is the amp there? And he goes, yeah. And I go, you have a guitar? And he goes, yeah. And I go, put it on standby. Standby is to let the elements heat up
okay.
in a vacuum tube situation. Mm-hmm. He put it on standby, and I go, do you have a guitar chord? And he goes, yeah. And I go, plug it into the amp. Okay, now turn it on. And he goes, should I play? I go, no, what you do need to do now is go get George Lynch. It's all ready to go, you know? If I wanted to sell magic beans, I could probably, yeah. But I wouldn't sleep at night.
You're kind of a genius, I would say.
At what?
At amps and guitars. I mean, playing, because I noticed, so I got your CD here, and if I had my spectacles, I would read you the exact quote. Oh, right, here it is. There is no bass player. It's right. Just Craig's thumb.
Right.
So several years ago when you know, your wife was going through her treatments. Anyway, we met up in Athens, and you played me something. I don't know if it's...
Little Martha.
It is a little... Okay. And you played it for me, and you think, I think it sounded pretty good and everything. And I just remember listening to it and thinking it was like multiple tracks laid on each other. And you told me that was just
one
you
track.
On one track. So.
Yeah. Well, that's... Now, when Dwayne Allman wrote it, he had two guitars on the track and an overdub. An overdub is where you go and add later after the recording and add another musical track.
Okay.
So you end up with three tracks.
Okay, gotcha.
But my version was the only way I could come up, and I don't play a lot of it correct, and I take creative design on it. Mm-hmm. I think that any person that's going to do a tune should make it their own. And if you know, it's one thing to learn it and regurgitate it. That's right. Cool. That's just learning.
Right.
But then to actually make it your own, everything is possible. I don't care who you are, you know, you just make it your own. I'm mm-hmm. big into making it my own.
Yeah.
And I'm big into certain subject matter. I don't go for some of the I love you, I love you, I love you tracks, mm-hmm. you know.
Silly love songs?
Yeah, well, Ed Beadle's not here, is he? So I love that part in Imagine, the movie. It's on prime time now. There's a part where George Harrison's sitting next to John Lennon. This is 1988. Mm-hmm. And he goes, I heard from Paul the other day, and Lennon just spouts off, oh, how is Ed Beadle doing? You know, but to call him Ed Beadle.
Oh, really?
You know, yeah, it's just like, you know, one of John Lennon's favorite things to say after the Beatles split up is he said, you don't have to be an Elvis Beatle anymore.
You don't have to be in the what now?
An Elvis.
Elvis Beatle?
Beatle.
Elvis Beatle?
Okay. See, so, you know, their big thing was to be bigger than Elvis.
Okay.
At John's mind it was.
Mm-hmm.
And then when the Beatles were gone, he's trying to say, we're not Beatles anymore.
Okay.
You know, it's over.
Right. Do you have your first or your earliest musical memory?
Yeah. My first musical memory, I wanted to play the guitar at 8, and they got me a Silvertone that never stayed in tune. Even as a professional later, I tried to get it to stay in tune, it wouldn't. But I went over to my grandparents' house, and I'd learned some songs. And I can't even remember those songs, but they wanted me to play, but I couldn't. Half the crowd wanted me to play, and half the crowd didn't want me to play mm-hmm. because of what it meant. And what it meant was they all knew that my real father was a musician. And if I could play, then the gig would be up. My real biological father, I didn't learn about him till I was 27 years old.
Mm-hmm.
I'm telling you how I felt, but I didn't understand what I felt.
Yeah.
But then later, my best first musical is learning how to play Bye Bye Miss American Pie by Don, you know, on the acoustic sitting on the back. I spent many an hour on the back porch of my car, you know, house
mm-hmm.
and my mother's apartment. As soon as at 14, I just took off. And then, of course, I got a van, so I'd practice in the van. But I wasn't allowed to practice in the house.
Well, really?
Yeah. My mother would leave. She had a stereo, And I sat there and learned Statesboro Blues by Dwayne Allman and Brother Band on 16 so I could learn the slide parts. But we weren't allowed to use that stereo, so I had to be like some kind of major. Everything is just the same, even exactly. The dust if necessary, you know. But no, we weren't allowed. I had a little radio that I could play when they weren't there. Mm-hmm. And I used to listen to AMRS radio, you know. Some of the tunes were really cool.
Yeah. So you weren't allowed to listen or play? I mean, kind of, or?
Not
was there,
house.
You think there
not
was a
my,
reason for
not
that?
In my mother's house, I wasn't.
Was that because of your real dad being a musician, you think?
Because they'd lied to me and said that I was another man's son. Okay. They even went to California and adopted me. And he never met me until I was possibly a year old or older. And yet it says on the birth certificate that he's my father.
Yes.
So they changed that all up. Hmm. I'm not trying to be a downer. I'm just...
No, that's interesting. I mean, you never know what is going to matter to some people or what they're going to think that matters. And if you had a knack for something, I don't know why anybody would want to squelch that.
Who knows?
Yeah.
You have to keep in mind, though, my mother had me when she was 15.
Right.
I've raised children. 15 are just kids.
Yeah, oh, for sure.
Nobody's got it figured out until they're probably 26, 27.
Yeah, that's...
So to throw...
Used to be fairly common back in the... Not that long ago.
Yeah. Oh, my grandfather passed when I was 14. But my grandfather, I was different. And my grandfather, when I wasn't in school, and he was traveling, but he would always make time to pick me up. And we had a farm ranch in Buffalo, Texas, mm-hmm. of about 254 acres. And so when I wasn't in school, I was with my grandfather learning how to shoot, learning how to track, learning how to stretch barbed wire.
So is this your mom's dad?
Yeah.
Okay.
He was a great man. And so I had love, you know, and he was always playing music for me on our travels.
Okay.
He had a reel-to-reel player that he played in his car.
Really?
And he asked me.
Like in the back seat? Or
no, we're in the front seat. Okay. They were real small, but they were bulky. Okay. And then he would play. He would record the Grand Ole Opry from the night before.
Yeah.
But he also would play me classical things like Billy Budd, the operetta or the opera, something of Billy Budd, Death of, I don't know. Billy Budd's all I remember. And he'd always ask me, do you dig any of this or anything this do for you? You know, but he never came out and told me the truth. But I imagine he was thinking about doing it later in life, mm-hmm. since it happened to him. Huh? That's what's so funny about the whole equation. It happened to him up in Pennsylvania when he was, oh yeah.
I imagine it's not that uncommon back in.
Oh God, I was talking to my cousin that I found on Ancestry, and she's big on going through the line, you know, to find people.
Mm-hmm.
And I have Hungarian blood, and it turns out she found out that over Western Europe or Eastern Europe, they don't do Ancestry because it could have been the mailman. It could have been, you know, what I mean. Nobody wants to know who their real father is. They just go straight ahead with it.
Whoever will admit to it or whatever.
I'm just saying as a whole, I imagine it's sort of like a can of worms. You know, anybody open and go, well, now I've done it.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, another thing about that is once you do know about it and you open it up, you're never know how it's going to all turn out.
Mm-hmm.
Well, when I was a kid, I used to sit on the swings and I changed the words to Beatle tunes.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I took Dance With Me and turned it into Cricket, My Little Cat. And I changed all the words, but I kept the melody.
Okay.
When I was 12, one of the memories that hit me, I was working, hitchhiking from Lake Highlands to Mockingbird and Central, and I was working as a busboy at Roscoe White's barbecue, whatever it was, next to the Losers Club. And I did the dishwashing. I took the trash out. One night I was taking the trash out, and I was 12. And I hear this music, and it knocks me out. So I walked over there, and about that time, the back door opened, and all the smoke poured out. What it was is the band stage had a, you know, back entrance.
Mm-hmm.
And they were right there. It's almost like lined up in a row.
Yeah.
And they were playing the stuff. Man, I found out later it was B.B. King.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow. The but guy it, that came out of the door? No, like his, the, he was
they
playing
were
there.
Playing.
Okay. Wow.
But I recognized the guy, but then when I saw B.B. King, I went, that's the guy from 12, you know. But that was back in the day when you could hitchhike there and back.
I was going to say, you're 12 years old. How'd you get to Mockingbird in Central?
I hitchhiked.
Okay.
Nobody took me to work.
Right.
I worked a lot to stay away.
How did you find that gig working there?
Phil Bush, a friend of mine, had okay. it.
You said
and they
you,
needed another one.
If you can get your, if you can get here, if you can get here, you can bus tables and...
I bus tables and dishwasher and trash out. And learned how to make great onion rings from this black lady that was a cook named Willie.
Mm-hmm. Is there a secret?
No.
Okay.
Just time.
Okay. Not getting in a hurry.
Don't be in a hurry.
Yeah.
You were asking me about Little Martha. Okay. When I worked up Little Martha, which is the... see the one I go right that tune. After I finished it, I wrote an intro to the tune, which is which was Martha coming into, I envisioned her coming into a backyard, butterflies and everything's, yeah. You know, just a kid.
Yeah.
Okay, so then I played Little Martha. And then after Little Martha goes, right?
Just like that.
And I let it fade. And then I go into, you know, after I heard the version of Little Martha recorded, finally after 50 years of working on it, I was ecstatic and decided I don't need this intro and outro. I'll do that live if I want to.
Mm-hmm.
And Dave took it, the pieces, and came up. He found on there, I don't know who I'm talking to in such a coarse language, like, you know, get over here or whatever I'm saying, you know?
Yeah.
And I think I know what I was saying. I was very frustrated. And we were trying to cut one tune, and I kept on messing up at the beginning. And then I just told him, after two or three tries, I go, just keep it rolling. No, just don't. You know what I mean? We're just going to keep on doing it till we get it. None of this start.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if you've done much recording, but...
I sure have not.
You know, then, believe me, we're all different animals once I hit that button.
I'll bet so.
Sort of like looking in the mirror. We can make a list of 50 uglies, but we can't say one good thing about ourselves.
All right.
We go. But my shoulders look really good, you know?
But that belly.
Oh, but that. Belly. I was thinking more like, is that a zit on your forehead?
Is that as ears? Is that Is that an antenna coming out of your ear?
Right. Well, I have hair on my ear, so I made a joke with Andrea. She expects me to maintain those, but they get pretty long.
Yes, they do. Quick.
And I just don't understand this. I don't understand a lot of etiquette, like chewing with your mouth closed. Everybody knows it tastes better with you open. So you're doing it to be codependent with other people in the room.
What made you, I mean, the songs you said came across over decades.
No, most of the stuff, a lot of the album I wrote when I picked back the guitar. Okay. So the gist of the record, yeah, some of the stuff had already been written, like The River, Romeo and Juliet, but most of it I'd never done before. Little Martha is something that I've always wanted to play, so I found it. Andrea just said something that meant, you know, shows you how I don't think. She goes, well, you're certainly capable of playing anything you want to. I guess you don't have it worked up because you just haven't got to it. Mm-hmm. And I went, I better get to it. Because that's correct. Yeah. And when she's correct, it's scary.
Yeah.
You know all about
that. You know you've been called out. Why this album and why now? Was it just the timing right? Things fell together?
Their album, you can thank Stephen Prigmore more than anything, because Stephen just called me up and said, we need to record you.
Good call.
Huh? Yeah, he set that all up. And he came over and recorded me for 2 days. But it was mainly someone knocked on the door and said, I'm going to record you. And I said, okay.
Do I don't have to leave my house? He said, okay.
Well, no, I mean, there's a good acoustics
in
here.
Yeah, it is.
Dave Parks, who was out with Eric Johnson for 12 years, he went and got his business master's or whatever degree. And started doing business consulting, computer software and for big companies. Mm-hmm. It just so happened about the time that we were talking, he said that he bought a bunch of outboard gear and he was getting back into mixing.
Oh, really?
And there's a lot of cassette tapes that I have and he has of shows with Eric and shows with a lot of shows with different people. He went out with people like Earl Bruford with Yes on Earthworks, and I think he did, I can't remember all the people. I know one time he was doing a show, and before the show started, he was playing basketball with Sting and Wayne Marsalis, you know, the jazz trumpet player. You know, so he got around.
Yeah.
And he said he was getting back into it, and he's worked on four of my albums. Mm-hmm. So it was a blessing. The only thing about it is once Dave's involved, he takes his time.
Right.
And it's got to be perfect. And I must have about 462 versions of all the cuts on the record, different versions.
Yeah.
You know, just to.
That's what you say in that. Is it in Romeo and Juliet? Which one is it you say, take 412?
That's just a joke.
I figured it was.
That was like, I couldn't get Romeo and Juliet just right. Mm. And I must have played it 2 or 3 times. And because it was so funny, the first day we wiped out everything and some of them the first take. And then the second day, I worked on 2 tunes and Romeo and Juliet was one of them. And I can't remember the other tune that we spent all day on. There's an inner voice and you when you record, and you know, when I'm practicing, I'm just practicing. Mm-hmm. As soon as there's another person in the room, you're performing. And that's why all of a sudden you turn on that. And then that's a thinking voice. And the thinking voice has nothing to do with music. It's there to go, you have the mechanics, you go E major chord, right? And then I'm gonna play it without thinking about the E major chord. And then I'm just going to play. And then if you're lucky, you get played. Mm-hmm. And you're not thinking. It's just happening.
Right.
But so that was what we try to capture when we're playing for recording. But that inner voice is just, like you said, what kind of ears are those, you know? My God, you smell like my granny. Because if I did all the tunes that I knew immediately would get, clapping and people digging it, then I probably would get very bored, and I would not want to. I mean, I spent years playing covers with bands on the road, but now, because of my belief that an artist is here to be asociable, we're not here to tell you what you think you want to hear. We're here to reflect back society at people. I found that once people start to dig you, their first thing is to sort of try to put you on the pedestal. But then they tear you down when they find out you're not perfect. I've seen that happen many times. If they clap and they like it musically, that makes me happy. But I'm filling up a hole, you know, with music. I think the sheer thrill of performing is it. Even though, like me, every time I pull up to a gig, I don't care how big, how many people were there, or how big a gig it was, I just think I'm going to screw it all up. I look in the mirror and go, you're just going to screw it all up. And then I get on and I start playing, and then I realize that, well, this is what I was made for doing. We all create our own hell. It's just the way it is.
I remember when you were nice enough to play along with me and everybody else at the Forge, I can remember when I was, so we would get there, you know, and you'd sign in and you'd turn and you'd know who you're after and this and that. And then I couldn't really relax then because I was thinking, okay, God. I don't know about that B minor. I don't know how I can do that. I don't know how I can do that. And then, you know, then I'm, I was always trying to, because I knew the songs vocally, but I was trying to play enough to where it wasn't terrible. And then, so I couldn't really relax. And then when I played three songs or whatever, and I would come back, and then I was like, I was in another universe. I was like, what just happened? I was I don't know, just coming down off something.
It's a peak experience. I guess so. And you can have a peak experience where the ceiling goes away and the bottom goes away, and you don't remember what you're doing or what you did when you're through with it, but you get that feeling. Yeah. And that feeling is rather euphoric, but that means you're being played. Yeah. For me, that means you're being played. Okay. In other words, you're the instrument now.
Okay.
In other words, your vocal is an instrument, and you're being the instrument, and you're played by a higher power than yourself. But you're included. And that's the only way I can explain it. I call it the creator, but, you know, to me, the creator means, walk on Tonkin means great mystery. I don't know, have a clue. Everybody else has a clue, and they're all digging it, you know, but I don't have a clue. But I can agree with that. Mm-hmm. I can agree with the fact that I didn't create a blade of grass. I can't do that. And I can agree that I didn't make myself, that there had to be some kind of creation involved. Mm-hmm. And I can dig that it's a great mystery. Because nobody's come back and said what it is. But everybody, you know, just like Albert King, it's just funny as hell, man. He nipped it in the bud. He goes, nobody wants to die, but everybody wants to go to heaven. You know what I mean? You know, I started the whole reason that I started playing at the Forge. I don't know if you know this, but Bugs Henderson died.
Okay.
The night before, on a Thursday night, it was raining heavy. I heard he passed that night. And when I heard that morning, I called up Brooks and said, man, the hole's too big. I got to fill it up somehow. Can I please play? And I went up there and played Friday and Saturday for 3 hours, like from 3 to 6. Mm-hmm. The hole had to be filled. Right. Just like my grandfather leaving, and just, I mean, I knew Bugs since I was 16.
Yeah.
And I was talking to him quite a bit towards there at the end.
Mm-hmm.
Bugs was incredible. You have to understand, I come into the scene, and they're in their 30s probably, yeah. And I'm like 19, you know.
They probably saw a lot of themselves.
I don't know. Yeah, I don't. As far as I don't know. I remember was doing a session at January Sound, and they had Nitzinger here and Bugs here on acoustic guitars, and I had an acoustic guitar, but I was playing dobro on it. Mm-hmm. And Ray Wiley Hubbard was in the sound booth to sing backups, and it was sort of a cowboy blues ballad.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm sitting there, and then the guy comes on the headphones and says, "Craig's going to take the ride," you know. And I felt like, wow, these guys are, you know, big time, and I'm just some kid. Then for some reason, as that session went on, every time John Nitzinger tried to play something, Bugs would play something that was correct, but made him sound like he was wrong.
Hmm.
In other words, he was, you know, just not, the groove wasn't. And I just felt this incredible weirdness. And I went into the vocal book, you know, they said take a break. And I just met Ray Wally Hubbard, and I go, man, is it me? I mean, what's going on in there? Because is it because I'm taking the ride or whatever? And Ray just said, "Craig, can't you feel the love?" And then I found out about the history between Bugs and Nitzinger.
Oh, okay.
Which was pretty outrageous.
Okay.
You know what I mean? But it was nothing to do about me.
Backstory.
The guys probably didn't even speak back then, you know. And here they are. Yeah, I must have been the young upstart in a way.
Yeah.
But I tried to be traditional. And then I think a lot of people saw I was learning everything I could as quick as I could and playing with, you know, mainly black bands
mm-hmm.
and black people. Went off on the road with a rock and roll southern band
mm-hmm.
who got a chick singer. So we went from Free Bird to Precious by the Pretenders.
Oh, really?
You know what I mean? We turned the whole thing around.
Yeah. What does music do for you? Like when you're feeling crummy, when you said, like you said, talked earlier, you were kind of curled up on the bed or on the floor. If you can make yourself come
you know,
back to the music, does it help you in some way?
It fills a hole, but not depression. I mean, depression is just like people don't understand. And once again, everybody's depression is as unique as their fingerprints.
Mm-hmm.
So for me to give any advice to a depressed person.
No, I'm just talking
about. No, I mean, what got me through my depression was a series of books in the 80s written by a man. It was called the Morita Logotherapy. A psychiatrist came up with ways to get people to recover from the bomb in Japan mm-hmm. during World War II. And the premise of it was you have feelings, but you're not in control of your feelings. You don't have direct control. You can't summon up instant hate or joy. The concept was accept your feelings. Second step is to know your purpose. And the third set is do what needs to be done. And I did it. I worked that way in everything. You know, I wish I'd known that a series of pills would kept me from hitting the bottom. And then when I had cancer and everything, I not only did I have cancer, I had depression, I had anxiety, all sorts of things. And, you know, I'm over all that. But to show you how it was, I never sat around and practiced guitar. I mean, I may have learned a song or two when I was playing the Forge all that time.
Mm-hmm.
But this time now, I'm practicing. I started out doing 8 hours a day.
Yeah.
And I'm still practicing. I can't imagine that I play as much as I do,
mm-hmm.
but I'm always playing the set for a live, you know, to play live. And there's a part of me that goes, well, why do I want to play live? I made a deal with the Creator a long time ago that if they asked me to come and play, I would come and play. And it doesn't matter where it is.
Yeah. So number two that you were talking about a while ago is finding your purpose.
That is hard. But I've always known my purpose, and that's to play music. But in the same sense, you know, my kids growing up, as far as arts and stuff like that, Joshua has a full degree in art and acting. And Haley has a degree, a couple of degrees, but she's fluent in Japanese, and she's made it her life where she's actually living there for the last 10 years. Mm-hmm. You know, that was important to her. But I told them stories about, like, did you know that Wes Montgomery, the famous jazz, did you know that he never quit his day job the entire time that he played?
Really?
And then stuff like John Cleese from Monty Python. Mm-hmm. Did you know he was a full-blown doctor before he took off with Monty Python?
Mm-hmm.
He's a doctor. He's known as Dr. John Cleese. You point those kind of things out. Being born and wanting to play music doesn't guarantee you anything.
No.
Remember Jimmy Rogers, the yodeler?
Yes.
Okay, I played with his grandson out of Nashville on a record. And they came through Dallas, and they invited me to come and play with them, you know, while they were playing. And after sound check, I went outside, smoked a cigarette, and he sat down with me like you're doing right now, and just looking at me. And he goes, damn, how come you're not famous? And I told him straight up, I said, someone can be talented and have something going, but has it ever occurred to you that that's all there is? If this is as good as it gets, are you going to dig it? In other words, have you put on the table that you may not make it in this business? Guy just never put it on the table because he's still pushing straight ahead. He was young. They had a record and they were doing good. And that's just the way it works. It's like everybody knew who Bugs Henderson was, but Bugs never made it big time other than the tour he did with Nitzinger. But he was known forever, everywhere. And everybody, Bugs had a group called Fancy Space when I was 16, 17. And he'd play every Monday night at this place called the Abbey Inn. And he had Slide and Stevie Davis playing slide and singing. Stevie could sing,
mm-hmm.
and he could play slide. He showed me how to play slide. All he did is show me where to put it and then said, you're on your own. But I stole him from Bugs's group later. But going and seeing them every Monday night, every player that wasn't working was in the room. They sounded like Derek and the Dominoes live every night. Incredible stuff. But I made good money at what I did. I was somewhat good at business, but when it came to, because I had to feed everybody else, you know. But a lot of that stuff that happened to me, they just happened. I remember a friend called me and said, there's a guy in Fort Worth that's really good. I forget his name. And he wants to get some recognition, and he wants to know how to become a Texas Guitar Tornado. I said, I don't know, but I'll find out who chooses it, you know, and I found out who chose it, and that's it. I told him, and then he sent me a cut. Another friend sent me a cut, and it was a really good rhythm and blues cut,
mm-hmm.
real tasteful and everything. I sent it out in an email to everyone, and nobody responded. You know, they're looking for positive feedback. Not anybody said anything.
Yeah.
The world is getting more and more detached.
Mm.
Don't you think?
Kinda, yeah.
I'm trying to get better at being personable, but I'm so consumed with thinking about playing.
Mm.
You know, I'm trying to get my head straight. You know,
yeah.
They're all there to have a good time. I'm there to try to perform.
Yeah.
And once again, you know, coming out with material that totally different. But if you've ever heard all my albums, every one of them's different. I did a record in 91 called Something to Say. And everybody had seen me on the Guitar Hero circuit. So I've been playing in front of all these big people and playing with them and stuff like that. And I released a record. And everybody went, man, you're not doing a lot of playing, you know, like leading out and stuff. I go, like you did in Endangered Species, you know. And I go, it's called Something to Say, you know, not Something to Play.
Yeah.
And then when I released Blue Over Yonder, it was just like the producer wanted to explore the Hendrix sounds that I could do. Mm-hmm. And I did that. It's like I'm nowhere as good as Thelonious Monk. Thelonious Monk had released 11 albums before he got a hit jazz tune, and they asked him what was the secret to his success, and he said, I just kept on making records, and sooner or later I know they would catch up.
Yeah.
You know, so catch up.
Yeah.
You know, because I don't even know what I'm gonna do. I mean, So Slow was done with the concept of where I might head next time, but not too many people could handle that cut, you know, because of the sounds and everything. Mm-hmm. But when I wrote it, I heard all that stuff in my head. But in the same sense, I dare anybody to say I've gotten away from the blues, because every tune is bluesy.
Yeah.
Has blues material, but it's not.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Yes. You were talking about your spiritual practice a little the other night at the Forge. What do you feel like something like that does for you?
Well, I got through the rest of the set somewhat cool. Mm-hmm. And like I said, if you'd asked me then and there, I would have told you I don't need to be playing live anymore. Yeah. Then I shared it with other musician friends, and I shared it with my wife, and it all came back to your perspective. From your perspective, it was a drag. But that doesn't mean everybody's perspective was that,
mm-hmm.
you know.
No, I mean, Melissa and I just sure wasn't. See you playing with TD and just hearing you do your thing. And
yeah. Well, I'm pretty rusty with accompanying people, so I found some groove, but I didn't find many.
Right.
Not like I used to. And he played some songs that I played on a recording. Mm-hmm. You know, I used to have parts of that thing, but
I guess the spiritual practice I was talking about was the... You say you went and sat in a sauna for 4 hours, the little box, the hot box for 4 hours.
I said that?
Yeah. Mm. You said you went up to Dallas and met your advisor.
I met somebody and I sat in a sauna?
Yeah, you said you had a hot box and you were in there for 4 hours, cleared your head. Maybe this was a bunch of years ago, but yeah, we talked about that.
Oh,
I was curious about
that. Oh, you're talking about the Inipi. The Inipi is went and did a traditional, what you call a sweat lodge, for 4 hours.
Right.
That made, yeah, I always wanted the Great Tap. I always wanted to be a great Christian. You know, I read everything I could find on it, but I never got the tap.
Okay.
That I knew. You know what I mean? Everybody says, well, you just have more faith. No, there's knowing and not knowing. And then in between is all that gray area that you boggy yourself down with. So when I didn't know, you know, and I wanted to be. I read, C.S. Lewis is still one of my favorite writers. I'm reading The Screwtape Letters right now because it's the best book on the human condition. And during the Christmas times, I found that not everybody is their best. You go out into the desert with a shaman. You call them medicine men, but they're really Wakam Wachashes, or Pajuta Wakam, or Pujuta Wishkaske, Wokong. There's many words for the different types of medicine men that you call medicine men.
Mm-hmm.
And I went into the desert. They get there right at the break of dawn. They are burning stones, big stones that are porous somewhat. You go into from the east into a sort of a mini building. Bearheart started the first round, and you go through four rounds. And in between each round, from then on, they put in more rocks, pour water on it. And it was like going to church.
Okay.
The church I always was looking for. And I did that, and a lot of things became clear. I had to wait 5 years for that to happen, for it to become a traditional with a tribe. Okay. You know, I'd been hanging out with Native Americans and doing things for the Native Americans since the 80s. Okay. And all because a lot of people say that they can't handle whiskey because they don't have a certain gene. Mm. I feel that Native American men are emotionally connected, okay? Most men are up in their heads or down in their gonads. If you ask them how they feel, they go, I don't know, or I love you, or they quote Yeats because he was pretty connected. You know what I mean? But overall, they are not connected to their emotional body. And I think that's when they drink, like being as in touch with it as a woman, you know, they just go a little berserk. But I may be wrong. I don't know. But I was hanging out with them, trying to find out if there's a ceremony or some kind of discipline to make me emotionally connected. I worked and worked and worked on it. I went to men's groups in the 90s and okay. I did all sorts of work. I've always been working. I know that I have two types of blood, but nobody's going to say it. But I do know that my grandmother, when I graduated high school, she gave me a book on North American Indians. And in the front part, it goes, Craig, you need to check out your heritage. So, you know, that was like pretty much proof. Because my grandmother would never say anything unless it was correct. And my grandfather didn't get a chance to tell me about, he was Irish and Cherokee. Now, some people will say, well, he wasn't Cherokee. And I go, man, you look at the pictures. I don't think too many Irish guys have jet black hair. You know, we're talking blacker than black, you know. Actually, I have a picture of him holding a pistol, suspenders all dolled up. And he looks just like John Dillinger.
No, really?
Yeah. It's like, wow.
Got any music heroes you want to mention?
No. Something that happens, and it's been going on ever since Mr. King had his first, I played the first Freddie King benefit with all the guys from Freddie's band and his son, who looked just like Fred. Yeah. Senior at Lee Park. Everybody showed up to play, but they were wanking on their own stuff. Oh. They weren't even playing Freddie King. There was one band called Rambunction from Iowa, Ohio. They had moved down here, and they played Freddie King tunes. Oh. But even the Freddie King Jr. band, we could have played Freddie all night, but we didn't. We played stuff like I Wish and Superstitious and, you know, dance tunes. Stevie Wonder and all that kind of stuff that we were playing in the clubs.
Yeah.
You know, I don't think people will want to think of me as when I'm playing in black clubs, they probably think, oh, he's playing cool stuff. No, I was playing Car Wash, Disco Lady, Shaft. You know what I mean? Every time I'd ask Deacon, I'd go, Deacon, let's do a blues. Oh, man, don't bring him down. Don't bring him down. You know?
Thank you for turning me on to Freddie King.
Oh, God, he's incredible, isn't he?
Yeah.
Talk about a man with a voice. And he's a very interesting human being. But, you know, what I'm saying, when they do these benefits, and I've seen this for everybody, Alex Moore, the piano player that was born in 1899 that I played with, they did a benefit for him. And all these people showed up, and they were just playing their stuff. They never probably even heard Alex's stuff. But they're all up there, and it's a fundraiser, I understand.
Yeah.
But when I went up to Alex and shaked his hand with the $20 bill in my hand, he said, let's go get something to eat at his own benefit. You know, when we were heading out the door, when some young man came up and said, Dad, where are you going? And he goes, we're going to go get something to eat. You know, and he goes, Dad, they're doing a benefit for you. I think you need to stay here. And he gave me that look like, you must be a bad influence. And it's like, no, I'm just going with him to eat. He said he wanted to eat. But when people die that are famous, semi-famous, or whatever, just like Stevie, everybody comes out with, he was my best friend. Mm. I had a friend of mine, really incredible slide player. And I won't say his name, but he got cancer. And it was really bad. And they had a couple of years or something. I think he's doing much, much better. But they had a benefit for him. and a lot of people of repute were on the charter to play. And a friend of mine was standing back there with him, and some guy from security came up and said, there's some guys at the front, you know, still not open yet. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like sound checking and stuff like that. And they said, there's some guys out front who said they really like to play too. Everybody just got cold. You know, they didn't say anything. And the guy whose benefit it was finally said, look, I'm the one who's dying. Fuck them. Because they all come up out of there. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's like, say somebody comes up to a Stevie Ray memorial. They show up and say, I want to play. Well, what Stevie tune are you going to do? Oh, I'm not. I'm going to do Zombie by the Cranberries, you know? It's like, yeah, you're not.
Not today.
When Stevie first died, I sat down and wrote down about 5 pages. It was printed up for about 5 pages, but I wrote mainly about the loss because I was angry for a year because Stevie was working on that alcoholic thing and he was changing people's life. And they're all going, man, if Stevie's here, maybe I need to be here.
Mm-hmm.
And the thing, which is funny because I'll tell you a story. When Stevie, they all went to this place sort of near Highland Park. I forget where it's at exactly, but it's on the borderline of Highland Park. Mm-hmm. It was an AA place.
Mm-hmm.
Stevie was going to that one, and Guthrie was going there, I think. But I don't know that he really had a problem. I don't know why Guthrie was there. It may have been somebody else, so sorry, Guthrie. And Ray Wally Hubbard came in. And he comes up to Stevie, my friend said, he goes, we can own this joint in about 6 months, you know? I never knew anybody that wanted to own an AA meeting, you know? Like, yeah, right. we got this all under control, you know? 1981,
mm-hmm.
I was supposed to meet Greg Allman, and his manager wanted me, because I played slide so well, he wanted me to join the Greg Allman group. And the opening was Stevie. We busted each other's balls about some stuff. After I told him I'd just traded in $1,700 guitar and another $1,000 to get the Dot neck that I got. And he goes, somebody just came up while I was playing in Austin and gave it to me. And I'm like, fuck you, Stevie. God, you know? And then so we go upstairs and there's an upstairs little green room. It's not very big.
Yeah.
He's going, man, I got to get a dumbbell because I'm going to be recording at Jackson Brown's place, which is turned into the record, first record. I go, fuck dumbbells, man. And then he goes, Greg, come here and look. And he pulled out a t-shirt and he goes, one of only 10 ever made. And it was Hendrix burning a guitar, but it was from the period.
Mm-hmm.
And I go, fuck Hendrix. And he's going, fuck Duane Allman. And I'm like, you know, and then while we're talking, the whole time on the door and giggles. And finally, Tommy Shannon went up to the door. He opened it up and there was 3 girls, beautiful girls. And he goes, not right now. And he shuts the door. And Stevie's sitting there on this little bench with his back to the wall. He goes, now they show up, Craig. I just got married. So that's why I used to play Lenny. Because he wrote that tune about his old lady.
Okay.
That, you know that.
I recognize it.
It's just an instrumental.
Okay.
But it's on
Lenny. Yeah.
Lenny.
Okay.
You know, all the others, we all grew up listening to the same cats, man.
Yeah.
All of us did, you know. That's just the case about being a Texas musician. It's a smorgasbord of all sorts of stuff.
What was the kind of his... Maybe his big hit, maybe after he had been recovering.
Dave Bowie? Talking about when he played with David Bowie?
No, it's a song that I have on my deal. It's Crossfire. I love that song.
I will tell you that there's a tune called Riviera Paradise. It's an instrumental.
Okay.
And it just goes and goes and goes. I will tell you that when Stevie was trying to make amends to all the people with the AA program,
mm-hmm.
that song is about trying to make amends with all the people that he couldn't get in touch with.
Or,
yeah, it was an amends song. If I had to, one other tune that I really dig that Stevie did is Life Without You.
Life Without You.
Yeah. It's a ballad, and it's pretty much, I feel like the tune is about Charlie, because Charlie died early, went out to California and died. And we're all, Charlie had this guitar shop, and he's very supportive of Stevie.
Where was that shop at?
Harry Hines and Small Street. It's still around. It's Charlie's with L-E-Y-S. Okay. You can look up the history of Charlie's. Mm-hmm. But it was just a little shop. But Charlie was really a positive person. He had Rene Martinez, Zach Berry, who now is Clint Black's tour manager. You know, they all worked on guitars for him. Mm-hmm. One time I walked into the store, and sitting at the counter was Charlie and Billy Gibbons. Mm-hmm. And they had a Strat. They're both laughing their head off. I don't know why. Billy's hitting a couple of notes on it and stuff. I don't understand, but I walked up and said, "Hey, what's going on?" And they go, "Craig, you got to play this guitar." So I picked it up and started playing. Wasn't hip to an amp or anything. They were still laughing. And I go, "What is this? Pick on the young kid? You were laughing when I got here, and now you're laughing again." And they go, "Craig, no, we're not laughing at you. Look at the headstock." So I looked up there, where it always says Fender Stratocaster, right? Instead of Fender, it said Fucker. And that was guitar that Billy was taking out. Oh, okay. You know, so like Fucker. But I guess that's is lame, isn't it? Not as good as hanging out. But we were just people, man. Yeah. No more than me and you talking. Somebody wants to make it bigger, better, let them do it, man. You know, but I refused not to talk about my life openly for the point where somebody may think I'm name dropping. It's not. I'm talking about my life. I'm not talking about anything spectacular. But if I, just like me telling you, Billy Gibbons and Charlie, Fucker, you know, it happened. Yeah. It was part of my life. It was just a story.
Yeah.
And people aren't going to know stories until somebody tells them.
You're right. There's only three of you there. I appreciate you telling stories today, Craig.
Oh, you're welcome, brother. Anytime. But anyway, you want to try it? I'll give you an intro, and you can hear the brother band coming in if you want to in your head. So I'm going to start it, okay?
Okay. Crossroads seem to come and go. Gypsy flies from coast to coast, knowing many, loving none, bearing sorrow, having fun. But back home he'll always run to sweet Melissa. Freight train, each car looks the same. They're all the same. No one knows a gypsy's name. No one hears his lonely sigh. There are no blankets where he lies. In all his deepest dreams, a gypsy flies with sweet Melissa. Sunbeam shining through his hair, appears not to have a care. Pick up your gear and gypsy, roll on, roll on. Crossroad, will you ever let him go? Will you hide the dead man's ghost? Or will he lie beneath the clay? Will his spirit float away? This I know, that he won't stay without Melissa. This I know, that he won't stay here without Melissa.